everyone, and welcome to our first Germination Retail Roundtable webinar. Today we'll be looking at what's ahead in 2018 and what growers are looking for. My name is Mark Zinkowitz. I'm the editor of Germination, and I'll be serving as your moderator. First, I would like to thank our sponsors, 2020 Seed Labs, Seedcan, and Canterra Seeds, for their support. I'd also like to note a few housekeeping items. This webinar is being recorded and will be made available on germination.ca following the event. Today we have three speakers talking about the topic of what growers are looking for in 2018, Jim Downey, Sarah Foster, and Jim Bagshaw. For audio quality purposes, all the microphones have been muted with the exception of speakers. After each speaker finishes their presentation, there will be an opportunity for questions. If you have a question or comment, please share them in the chat box, which you'll find on the bottom left side of your screen, and just let us know who they're directed to. We certainly welcome your input. Also, for those of you who are on Twitter, we'll be live tweeting during the event, so feel free to follow along. You can find us under the handle @germinationmag, and we'll be using the hashtag #SeedRetail. I'd like to introduce our first speaker. Jim Downey is Research and Development Manager for Seedcan. He's involved in providing numerous research grants to many plant breeders across Canada with the objective of providing improved crop varieties to Seedcan members. Jim is also involved in promotion and market development of new Seedcan varieties. Being a grower himself, Jim is going to speak about what's ahead in 2018 from a grower perspective. So let's get started. The floor is yours, Jim.
Okay, thanks. Jim Downey here. I farm near Saskatoon, mostly grow wheat and canola, but worked for Seedcan for about 22 years. Worked a lot of trade shows and talked to a lot of farmers about varieties. One of the first things I like to ask farmers when they're talking about new varieties is I ask them where do they farm and what crops they're growing now and what varieties and what they think about those varieties or those crops. So that gives me an idea, a snapshot idea of the lay of the land of their farm, whether it's hot and dry, cool, wet, and the crops are growing. And I really want to know what issues they've been having. So, Mark, can you have the next slide there? I'm not sure if it's... There it goes. So I'm just showing a picture here of wheat. So I deal mostly in wheat, barley, oats, and flax, a little bit in soybeans. And so I'm going to talk a lot about wheat, but this applies to other crops too. So farmers are often looking at the crop that they just grew, and they'll look in the rearview mirror, and they'll think about the crop they just grew, and if they're looking for a new variety, they're going to be looking to address some of the issues they might have had in their crop. So I'm just showing here AAC Brandon. I grew this crop in 2015, the first year Brandon was available, and just illustrating a variety that will be on a lot of acres this year and could become one of the top wheat, hard red spring wheat varieties on the prairies. So I show that variety because there's been a lot of there'll be a lot of chatter about that variety. And then just another shot of it here, the next picture. Farmers have moved a lot to Brandon partly because it addressed a lot of issues from that they had in 2015 and 2016. One of the issues was tall straw with a lot of lodging, but the biggest issue by far was Fusarium head blight in the wheat. And Brandon is a nice package because it has the shorter, stronger straw and the moderately resistant rating for Fusarium head blight. So just illustrating the fact that farmers respond to those issues by moving to a variety that tries to address some of those issues. So for this fall of 17, farmers are looking in the rearview mirror to say, how were things in 2017? What were the major production problems in my crops in 17? And will that get them to switch to a new variety? I often say farmers spend more time thinking about fertilizer and the machinery on the farm than they do about varieties. So if we get them to focus on a variety or variety selection for more than 20 minutes, we're doing pretty good. Some of the issues in the past, especially 15 and 16, were Fusarium head blight. So that caused a lot of switch over to varieties with the MR rating, or the moderately resistant rating to Fusarium head blight. This year, I'm already getting questions about low protein in wheat. So some growers, where they got some rain, got very good yields in wheat, but they've experienced low protein, and they're really wanting the higher protein because there's big premiums there this year. So that's going to be a question that comes up this winter. How do I get higher protein in my wheat? That may not even be that relevant in wheat for 2018, but it's still going to be a question in their minds. And they're going to ask, do I need a new variety to get better protein? Some guys in the south where they had a drought are going to think their straw was too short and they couldn't bale it for cattle feed. So there could be a few boys looking for taller straw just so that they have something more to work with, especially if they're swathing and trying to make feed. Some guys in the north, it's raining there now, only half done harvesting in a lot of areas across northern Alberta, northern Saskatchewan. They're going to be thinking about maturity. Some of their crops are going to be late. Some of them are going to have issues with sprouting. So that's going to drive people to look for earlier maturity and better grade retention, better sprouting resistance. One of the issues that flies under the radar often is threshability. But farmers now with rotary combines, they're not very aggressive in threshing. And for wheat varieties that have trouble with threshability, that'll drive farmers to look for a new variety that has very good threshability. A variety like Brandon has good threshability, so that's another part of the package that they're going to like about that variety that might switch to that. This is the third year on the market for it right now, so there'll be even more acres of it next year probably. Midge and sawfly insect resistance. For some growers, they want to stay with midge-tolerant wheats. That narrows down the list of varieties they're going to look for. And in the past, sawfly was a big issue. So just some concepts of what farmers are thinking about, I think, this coming fall. Now, I just want to talk about some of the ways I help farmers narrow down the list of varieties that they look for. I'm just trying to switch to the next slide. It's not coming up yet. Maybe take a minute. Anyway, I'm just going to illustrate using, in this case, Saskatchewan crop insurance numbers. But you can do this in the Prairie Provinces, at least. I'm not sure about in Ontario. But they compile the most widely grown varieties. So this just gives the top five hard red spring wheat varieties grown in 2016. So again, this looking in the rearview mirror, older data, you can see Brandon was down the list there, fourth from the top. Utmost of the top being image tolerant wheat. Brandon will likely move up that list closer to the top this year. But all those Cardell, Carberry, Brandon, Plentiful are on that list because they address the Fusarium head blight issues. Another way, I'm just going to move on here to the seed guides. So that's a good way for farmers to narrow down a list of what other farmers are growing and what is popular on the prairies. This is just an illustration of the cover of the Saskatchewan seed guide. So most provinces have a provincial seed guide which compiles the data from provincial variety trials. And so this is the Bible that I use at trade shows to open up with farmers to look at objective data, not company data. This is actually data produced through provincial variety trials. And so I'm just going to give a snapshot here of the next slide is the wheat tables. And then, so that just gives you an idea of how busy the tables are. I'm going to zoom in here in the next slide to just zooming in on the top of the hard red spring wheat table. And I'm actually going to just illustrate here with fourth from the top is AAC Brandon. So Carberry is the Czech variety at the top, and AAC Brandon is four lines down. A lot of farmers zoom in on the yield data, but I kind of direct farmers more over to the other agronomic data based on the height, the maturity, the lodging, and the Fusarium head blight ratings, along with some of the disease tolerance ratings. So I think it's almost more important to look at those other agronomic factors, especially in the case of if you want to address Fusarium head blight or lodging or height or maturity. You need to go away from the data and look for some of the earliest maturing lines or the best lines for Fusarium head blight resistance. If you go down to the second last line, it's hard to see it there probably, but it's called AAC Redwater. If you go down the maturity column, the maturity column is fourth from the right. You get the AAC Redwaters 5 days earlier, down a bit lower there from the green arrow, but it's about 5 days earlier than the Czech variety, so it's one of the earliest maturing varieties on the table. So if guys have had trouble with maturity this year, Redwater might be something they're looking at for the coming year. Another practical issues that I often look at, I'm just going to go to the next slide here, is in the back of the seed guide. And farmers often forget to look here. They're trying to narrow down this very long list of varieties that are available. If you go to the back of the seed guide, it gives you a listing of the seed growers that have grown various varieties. And this is useful because seed growers have to anticipate the demand 1 or 2 years ahead for various varieties. So if you have a long list of seed growers growing a variety, it's an indication that they anticipate very strong demand for that variety. And that means that variety will have be widely available. I won't have to drive as far to pick it up. And usually when there's more seed available, the price of the seed is a bit more reasonable. So anyway, this is just an indication. Farmers can go through a list and pick out a variety, and there'll be one seed grower, and they've got to drive to the next province, and it's just not feasible. So it's very important to look at how widely distributed is the variety, and you can find that list of seed growers in the back of the seed guide in the various provinces. There's other sources of information, too, that I like to pull in just to confirm what we talk about at trade show booths or with farmers or on phone calls. There's various websites from the various companies, CCAN, FP Genetics, Cantera, Alliance Seed Corp. They all have websites to give a summary of the information on their varieties. I also encourage farmers to phone seed growers to get the impression from the seed grower what they thought of the variety, because that's the seed growers are the first guys in the community to actually grow new varieties. And then also the Canadian Seed Growers Association, CSGA, has a seedlocator.net website, which is really quite useful. It also lists which seed growers have grown which varieties, and it gives you the pedigree, so if, whether it's foundation, registered, or certified. And it's really only when there's certified seed produced that the variety will be available. So that just gives you an idea of how widely grown varieties are and where I can pick them up. So a lot of growers will ask, or a certain subset of the growers will ask, what's new? And some growers really just want to grow new stuff. So my next slide here, this is actually 1 year old. This is from this previous spring, but this is about five or six new wheat varieties, which I was trying to summarize. Here's varieties that were available spring of 17 for the first time. So Jetheria, Cameron, and Connery were on that list, along with Bradwell. But with Jetheria, we had 13 seed growers versus Bradwell, one seed grower. So we know that Jetheria and Cameron be quite a bit more widely available than something like Bradwell. And varieties like Viewfield were not available until 18, along with Landmark, not available to 2018. But there'll be quite a bit of interest in those, Viewfield and Landmark, because they are new and short, strong strawed wheat. So this is just kind of a guide for farmers when they say, hey, what's new? Well, here's new stuff. But I often ask or encourage growers to maybe to even wait a year. Don't jump in the first year. If you can, that's fine. But seed is much more widely available in the second year variety is available, and often it's a bit more reasonable price. And you also get more of a track record to see how it did it for other people. So sometimes it's better to wait till a variety is actually in its second year where there's much more seed available. So just some thoughts there. Just to kind of wrap up on wheat, I just want to illustrate one other concept, AAC Penhold, the CPS red wheat. Many of you probably know this already, but it's CPS red wheat. Penhold was a big step ahead because it had fusarium head blight resistance. It was MR for fusarium. It's widely grown in Alberta. Many people, quite a few farmers have tried it in Saskatchewan and Manitoba, but it's not going to be widely grown because there's a couple things that happen. It's regionally adapted, but also the grain markets and the grain handlers in Alberta tend to, they favor these varieties, but in Saskatchewan, Manitoba, the grain companies, they don't get critical mass, not enough of this variety to handle, so they tend to discount it. They don't even want to bring it in the elevators, and it discourages farmers from growing something like these CPS red wheats, even though they can be very well adapted and it can grow well and have high yield in the various provinces. I'm just going to move along here to another newspaper article on Penhold that got a lot of interest in it. Showing here, this is just a picture of Penhold growing in central Alberta. And the next news article here from the Grain News, yielding over 100 bushel an acre, very high yielding variety, gets interest, but when you go to haul it to the elevator, quite a big discount, the CWRS, especially in Saskatchewan, Manitoba. So we can't just go to the seed guide, we also have to understand the grain markets too to know what to recommend. Just moving along, I just want to mention, just in closing, moving to the next slide, just a word about soybeans. This is the crop insurance information on soybeans, showing the top five varieties growing in Saskatchewan. You can do this in Manitoba also. It gives you a sort of a smaller list of varieties that people are actually growing. It's interesting that the top variety, Isis RR, is actually a Roundup Ready 1 variety, and it's not even found in the Saskatchewan Seed Guide. And so there's something different going on there where, you know, there wasn't a company that wanted to put it into the trials, and it wasn't tested in the trials, it doesn't show in the Seed Guide. So the Seed Guide is not perfect. It doesn't always give us the full slate of information. But most of these varieties here, the other ones, are in the Seed Guide. And the one thing I did want to note here was there's a lot of soybeans in central Saskatchewan and to the north that are still in the field waiting to get harvested. It's getting cooler and wetter, a little bit of snow in the air. And so maturity will be a huge issue in soybeans for a lot of the prairies after this year. And just waiting for the next slide to come up here with the Seed Guide information. Just using the Seed Guide information, you can see here that I'm going to compare the company maturity rating is given there, but the days to maturity are actually taken out of the trials, and you can see there's some pretty large differences in days to maturity versus the company maturity rating. So most farmers, I encourage them to look at the days to maturity rating. That's going to be a key issue, especially when we get into Saskatchewan, Alberta, where soybeans are not quite as well adapted. We're waiting for earlier, better maturing material for the cooler part of the prairies. So that's just a word on soybeans, that soybeans take a fair bit more research as a new crop to figure out which varieties are really the best adapted for certain areas. And that takes some phone calls to provincial oil seed and pulse specialists and to companies. So that's about it for me at this time.
If you have questions for Jim, please type them into the chat box now. We'll now commence with a short Q&A part of the webinar. Jim, can you recap for us what the main factors are that you think will influence growers in terms of variety selection in 2018?
Sure. Farmers are going to look in the rearview mirror, and it's going to be different in each part of the province what issues they had with their varieties. In the south, where they had drought, there's going to be the search for yield, search for drought tolerance. For some people, if their straw was too short, they might want to switch to a bit taller variety if they're trying to make feed, because feed availability was a huge issue for cattle this year. So they will want taller straw, perhaps. In the south, they might swing away from hard red spring wheat or barley back into durum because they had less issues with fusarium head blight. So that'll be a huge factor coming up in the southern part of the prairies where they grow durum. For people in the north, where they had a bit more rain, quite a bit better crops, lodging resistance or straw strength, they're going to be looking for short, strong straw varieties that they can straight cut. Already questions about low protein in wheat because of the protein premiums that are in the marketplace. So farmers are going to be asking, how do I increase my protein? Do I need a new variety to get better protein? That's a tough question to answer. People in the north where it's raining and the late harvest, late maturity, especially if they've applied a fungicide, which also delays maturity, they're going to have maturity questions. They might want to look for earlier maturing lines and possibly some sprouting issues in the north where it's raining.
Now, you may have already touched on this a little bit, Jim, but for you, in your opinion, if you can sort of gaze into your crystal ball a little bit, what are the biggest overall challenges you see coming next year for growers, be they agronomic, economic, weather issues, or what have you?
Well, I think that what's top of mind right now is Justin Trudeau's new tax laws that he's proposing. I think that's top of mind for quite a few guys. So that'll be one of those economic landscape changers, I think, for some people. You know, club root was found in canola in Saskatchewan this year, so that's something new on the scene in Saskatchewan. We didn't think it was an issue. I think that's going to influence canola variety selection, possibly. We don't do a lot in canola, but I just know I do grow a lot of canola, and that is definitely a variety selection consideration, is club root resistance. Wheat protein, I think that'll be the big question. And some of the soybeans are coming. I'm hearing some low yield numbers in soybeans in Saskatchewan. So big question will be, do I grow more soybeans? And what do I grow? And can I get something earlier maturing?
Well, thanks so much, Jim. I'd like to switch over to Sarah Foster now. She'll be our second speaker of the day to talk about grower wants and needs in 2018 from a seed health perspective. Sarah is president of 2020 Seed Labs. She studied and qualified as an accredited seed analyst at the National Institute of Agricultural Botany in Cambridge, England, Her work experience includes 7 years with Sharp Seed International in the United Kingdom and 5 years with United Grain Growers in Edmonton after immigrating to Canada in 1984. The floor is yours, Sarah.
Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you, Jim. That was really, really informative. It's good information for us here from a seed testing perspective. So what I'd like to talk about, obviously, we have a very good relationship with a number of retailers and seed growers across the country, so all across Canada, basically. And what we find is that really at the base of it, at the heart of it, is that every retailer and every seed grower wants their customer to be successful. And by being successful, that means that they're going to have repeat business and that they can see that they're doing something for their clients by, you know, providing the right variety for the right area. So in our opinion, I think what we see is if the retailers and the growers are supplying product that's working in a specific area, so go with what's in your area and what works for you, we find that that is very true to form. So initially, you know, when I think of what it is that we're looking at, we test seed from a number of different areas, and we find that when those best varieties are chosen for specific areas, we see very few disease issues or quality issues. And I know many of you have heard me talk before, and I basically say, you know, as soon as we see seed, whether we see it in the raw form or we see it in a germination test, we can tell a lot by what has actually happened to that seed. So there's some history hidden behind that seed, and once we start testing it, we unlock a lot of the information that has been there through the growing season and how the environment has actually impacted the quality of the seed. So ultimately, I think everybody's in the business to increase their profits. And a top of mind is yield. And everybody today wants the best yield that they can possibly get. And whether that's, whether they've chosen the right variety, I think that's got a lot to do with it for their production or for their area. It doesn't just stop with that. The crop rotation is hugely important and has a big bearing on what diseases have been left in the soil from previous years, whether it's, and again on straw and that type of thing, and really improving the quality of the soil through other techniques, through other farming practices. And I think it's also important to remember that seed should come to the grower or to the client treated. Seed treatment is hugely important, and that has a huge bearing on how that seed gets a good start from the very, very beginning. And I think we've also got to remember too that we want a positive impact on the environment, and whether that's buying clean seed, and knowing that you've bought clean seed, you have to know that it's been tested. And I'll be talking a little bit about that. But I think first and foremost, pure seed, seed that has the traits that you want for your environment, you know, for the area that you're farming in, and essentially using the right chemicals or the right chemistry, obviously, you know, for that production. And using science for optimal performance. So obviously selecting varieties, as Jim said, that have resistance to specific diseases, choosing cereals that are resistant to Fusarium head blight, choosing canola that's resistant or has some resistance to club root, and so on. And another thing is choosing varieties with shorter days to maturity. There's lots of that type of work going on with soybeans, and making sure that the disease and the vigor profile always match up with what it is that you're trying to target. So this is an example of a report of seed analysis, And I think it's really, really crucial that we put the word out and try to encourage as many retailers and seed growers to use this as their guarantee. Just as we think of the blue tag for certified production, I think that the report of seed analysis, regardless of which lab it comes from, as long as it's coming from an accredited facility, and you can tell where it's come from and if the lab is accredited by usually seeing a number, and ours is up in the top right hand corner, and we're lab 1068. So that's a sure sign right there that the testing that's been conducted, for the most part, especially with things like germination, disease and purity, are accredited tests and are recognised in Canada's grading system. The other thing that comes with this report is an assurance of quality. So these, you know, some tests have been conducted that are compliant with selling seeds. So all seeds sold in Canada has to be tested. And very few people know that you've got to have a germination. If you're dealing with barley, if it's not treated, it must be tested for smut. And obviously a purity. And today, most of the purity work is already done by qualified graders in registered seed establishments. In our case, we have trained analysts that are working on these tests. And we're always available for interpreting the results and the tests. And we try to put as much good information that we think is of value to our customers. And you can see on this report, we've highlighted various different things that we think are really important for our customers. So we try to get folks to think more about a germination. Germination is important, but things like the 1,000 kernel weight, hugely important in terms of setting seeding rates. Whether we like it or not, the digital age is here. Farming is definitely becoming very digitized, and people are looking to save money. And I think when you have some more tests in addition to the germination test, we can show you that we're actually helping you to save money. So rather than putting down, you know, 3 bushels an acre or £3 an acre, we can actually look at numbers now and make sure that those numbers that we've put in the ground of those seeds do develop and develop rapidly and evenly and so on. The other thing that is very, very important, and I'll talk about this in a minute in detail, is the cold stress test. Whether we like it or not, we live in a harsh country. Sometimes we have very good spring conditions, but for the most part, we've got cool spring conditions, and we need to be testing the seed on the other end of the spectrum rather than just on the germination spectrum. And then the other thing that's very, very important in terms of what growers are looking for is, how does my seed stand up to fusarium, and has there been any sign of it, especially in Alberta, in my crop? And then we talk about the remarks from the fusarium test, and I'll go into detail in that in a moment. So the germination, it's crucial. It's, as I say, required by law, and it's a test, when we do it in Canada, of 200 seeds taken from a representative sample. So it's very important that we get a good sample that represents the bin or the lot or whatever it is you have in terms of your seed on your farm or seed that you're selling. And the germination in this case is 91%. So the grade for most cereals is around 80-85. So this one's actually done very, very well. And we have a 91% with 7% abnormal and 2% dead. And we've got a note about this, and I want to draw people's attention to this. So there's a remark here that says that frost damage was suspected through the abnormal seedlings having grainy coleoptiles and leaves that spiral or twist in the shoot system. So it's not that we want to make our customers analysts, but we really like them to take some time and read over the report of analysis, because it tells you a lot about the quality of your seed and what you can expect when you turn around and plant it in the spring. So with frost, it's one of those things that never goes away. It can actually affect the quality of the seed in storage over time, because oftentimes the cell structures have been damaged through the frost and they continue to essentially deteriorate the seed. So if this seed is tested in the fall after harvest, and that's generally what we want to see, we know that this seed should be retested again in about 3 months' time to make sure that the seed's still holding its germination. So after the germination, we encourage people to have a vigor test. And having that vigor test can actually change your whole decision about whether you should be using that seed at all. And here we have a germination of 91 and the respective vigor, which has now got a score or a percentage of 75%. And this is an exact textbook situation where we've got a very good, well, a reasonable germination, let's say, of 91, but we know that in the background there's frost damage, and that has affected the vigor. And you would expect to see, with a good vigor, all of those seedlings on the right, on that blue blotter, to have sprouted, and they haven't. So we know that there's an underlying issue. So let's say if we'd done the vigor first and not the germination, we'd know through the vigor, because we've imposed some stress on it, that there is essentially a background issue. Now, it doesn't mean that it can't be used. It just means that it has to be monitored and it has to be managed. So it's very important to look at these numbers. And at one time, most labs just put out a number without any explanation. And I think it's really important to look at the diagnosis, actually what's happening in the background and how strong and how steady is this germination and vigor going to be over time. So in Alberta, we've been promoting a DNA and a plate for Fusarium. And we've actually been very, very successful with this, because what we're finding in years where there's heavy Fusarium infection, we'll more than likely pick it up on the plate if it's an internal systemic infection. So I use internal because that's a word that people do understand, but essentially it is systemic. So the infection of Fusarium is systemic and we'll pick it up on the plate. But a lot of the times in areas that are still managing to stay relatively free from Fusarium, we've been encouraging them to use the DNA, because the DNA will pick it up regardless of what the level is. And because the plate test washes the seed before it's put on the agar, there's a very good chance that the spores that are on the surface from a late infection, so an infection that's come in later and only affected the seed surface, we've noted that approximately 50% of the time, at least in Alberta, we're missing Fusarium. So it's important to do the DNA. Now, if the DNA goes positive and the follow-up plate goes negative, we've got some very good information there telling us that we've definitely had a late-seeded, a late infection, and that seed treatment should be used. So it's pretty much undetectable. What am I saying? I'm getting a little bit confused here. If we have a positive, I should back up here, sorry. If we have a positive DNA and a negative plate, it means that it's there and that we should be dealing with it. And it's not something that's not really essentially serious, but we do need to be treating for it. And so it's important that we have the two together. And the important thing is that we don't just do the plate. Now, I know that the plate is definitely one of the more easier techniques to use, and most labs use that. But at the end of the day, it's not telling us the whole story. So how does seed testing answer all of our questions about how we would go about seed selection? And this is something that we talk to our growers about a lot, whether it's at trade shows or presentations, that type of thing. We're obviously looking at using the best varieties for the best area. And we need to mitigate the risk by tracking the spread of disease. And talking to our clients in Manitoba, they do like to use the DNA and the plate because they can rank varieties that way. They can use that information scientifically to be able to tell how that particular variety has stood up under immense fusarium pressure. So that's, you know, specific to Manitoba. So that's been very encouraging for us to hear that, you know, what we're doing in the lab actually backs up what's actually happening in the field. And of course, that's what we want. Everything that we do has to be emulated or corresponding in the field. And I think managing the agronomics, we're very involved with helping people decide what feedlot they should be using based on the level of fusarium infection and what other diseases are on the seed. And there's a test that we do, which we call the fungal screen, and that looks at about 11 different pathogens that are ranked in order of how severe they are. And through that, we encourage people to use a seed treatment and to select the right seed treatment for that fungal profile. And I think that that's very important. And I know that there are seed varieties out there that are resistant to some of those things, but again, it's very much dependent on the environment. And this year, I think we can expect that we're not going to see as much infection as we did last year, because overall we've had a drier year, but we've only really just started harvest. And so we know in the north, northern Alberta right now, that there's still a lot of seed that hasn't been harvested. And obviously if it sits out much longer and is infected or affected by the environment, we're going to see some disease pressures. And that's especially true when we see canola. Another thing too is that, you know, we don't like to see sprouting, which can cause a lot of issues with germination and vigor. And I think overall, the best yields start with the best seed. And I think if we can play a part in being able to offer a package that is useful to our clients who can pass that information on to their farmers, I think that's really, really important. And I think we've gone a long way in terms of putting out different packages and explaining why these particular packages are really important. But I think we still have a long way to go, and I think we need to be working with people like Jim Downey and Jim Bagshaw on, you know, pushing out the information that it's not just your seed, there are other factors that come into play. And I think it's very important that, you know, we all work together to be able to produce some of the best seeds that we can. And I think my last slide is wishing everyone a happy harvest from 2020 Seed Labs, and I think I can take some questions.
Thanks so much, Sarah. Yes, we'll take a few questions for Sarah now. If you have a question for Sarah, please type it in the chat box at the bottom left-hand corner of your screen. Sarah, can you recap what you see as the biggest potential disease issues in 2018 and how growers might want to protect themselves?
Well, I think the biggest one that we still deal with is Fusarium graminearum. Last year, as I say, we had very, very high levels of infection. And this year, not so much. Mind you, we're only 2 months into the season, so we haven't been able... We document everything and we provide risk maps to our clients about the areas that are heavily infected and areas that are becoming infected. So I think it's really important that we don't give up testing. I think that, as I've already said, I'd like to continue to see the DNA test followed by the plate. And I make phone calls to everyone that has a disease test that when they're only asking for a plate, I try to let them know that the plate could potentially miss an infection because of the way that the seed is cleaned up before it actually goes onto the plate. So I am going the mile now to encourage people to go with the DNA test as well. And the reason I'm doing this is because Fusarium can be managed. And I think, you know, there are some heroes in this story in that the registered seed establishments across Alberta and other places, people who are testing seed, have tested the seed, you know, before it's gone into the plant and looked at, you know, what levels there are. And I mean, let's face it, there are areas in Alberta, Saskatchewan and Manitoba that are very, very high, and we know it's there. But it doesn't mean that you can, you know, give up hope. It can be managed. It can be managed through seed treatment, through using varieties that are resistant to it or have any kind of resistance to it is probably important that we use that. But I think testing and finding out what level you've got and finding out, too, if there's an early, you know, an early warning. So if we find it in the DNA and we don't find it on the plate, to us, that's an early warning that Fusarium is in the area. And growers can then be aware of what's being grown around them, because usually it's brought in by other sources. It's not necessarily always brought in by the seed. It's it can move it, you know, environmentally in the wind, and also if it's, you know, high humidity, high temperature, that type of thing. So I think you know, Fusarium is probably the big one, and then clubroot on canola. And I think that one of the things there is rotation needs to be managed. I think just because we've got resistant varieties or varieties that show some resistance to clubroot, and the same with Fusarium, I think it's so important that rotation is followed. And that's probably my message, Mark.
Do you still see a lot of growers who don't have their seed tested before planting?
Not growers. Seed growers and retailers, no. When seed is sold, it has to be tested. There's a good percentage, though, of farmers who don't test. And I think we need to do a lot of education there in that they need to be buying more certified seed on a regular basis, not just, you know, every 5 years. Which is something I hear. But there's a number now that are buying seed more regularly, and I think it's important, obviously, to support breeding in Canada and worldwide that, you know, we buy certified seed to support that. But, yes, there are certainly people that think that they can do a germination test at home, and... You know, they see the sample sprout and they think it's okay, but there are details that they will miss, and especially the frost damage that I spoke about. And I think, and there are other things, there's lots of other things that go undetected or unnoticed by someone who isn't trained to do it. But I think the big thing is that if you are using your seed over and over again, do you really know what you've got? And is it as healthy, and is it able to, you know, withstand all the pressures that, you know, seed withstands or plants withstand? And I think I find that very frustrating, that there's probably a good 60 to 70% of seed that goes in the ground that isn't tested. And I would love to be able to do a huge campaign to encourage those people to get their seed tested, because, you know, it's expensive to farm. And having your seed tested for, you know, $28 to $30 isn't a lot of money. And I think it's just, I don't know, it's just very easily overlooked.
One final question, Sarah. Someone asked about the fact sheet you showed earlier, which listed Fusarium as one of the dominant pests that you see. But I imagine, as you mentioned earlier, there's also quite a few other pests and diseases other than Fusarium that people need to be on the lookout for, and that seed testing can obviously help with.
Yeah. Well, Fusarium, it is one of the most important ones. I think, you know, as I say, it's top of mind with us because it's still on the Pest Control Act in Alberta, but it is number one. It's the one that we see first and foremost when we test for any disease. But there are, as I say, 11 others, things like root rot, rust, all those types of things that are also important. And we don't routinely test for those unless we're asked to. Another thing, too, is that if we haven't been asked, we have to do a fusarium, but if we haven't been asked to do a fungal screen, our analysts in the germination department, when they're doing a germination, will often see colonies of pathogens or diseases, if you like, on the seed. And if that happens, they'll take it over to our plant pathology department, and that will start the conversation about getting, you know, further tests done. So in answer to the fellow who's asking about, you know, why is Fusarium at the top, it's mainly because it's probably one of the most troublesome pathogens that we have worldwide. And we see it here in Alberta and in Saskatchewan and Manitoba, and it's one of those that, because it carries, you know, the vomitoxin, and it's problematic that way in terms of, you know, human and animal consumption. I think it's important that, you know, we're always on the watch for that. But there are other diseases that are of agronomic importance, and, you know, that's a whole other topic. But we are aware of them, and when we do find them, it's not the end of the world. We give information that allows a person to select a seed treatment that's going to be very beneficial on that particular portfolio, if you like, or that particular list of pathogens.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah. Last but not least, we're going to hear from Jim Bagshaw. He'll be our final speaker of the day, and he's going to tell us about what growers are wanting in 2018 from a seed company perspective. Jim is sales director for Cantera Seeds, and he's responsible for developing and managing the company's sales team throughout Western Canada. He's an industry veteran with a wealth of sales and management experience. He received his Bachelor of Science in Agriculture from the University of Saskatchewan. Jim, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mark. Well, good morning, everyone. Today's discussion, I'm going to keep many of my comments quite high level and not get down into the weeds and too much detail. And really, when I look at it, this is going to talk more about the trends and what we're hearing from growers of what are the hot topics for this coming year. As we know, with any genetics that are going into the ground and any new seed, ultimately the grower's net outcome is based on the combination of the genetics, their management style, and the environment. And without knowing a particular grower's management style or the environment, it's very difficult to say this will be the best genetics for that grower. That being said, there are clear trends that are showing here that are coming up that I'll talk a little bit about here in the next few slides. So first off, clearly we are hearing across Western Canada, there were some pretty significant changes in market share of crop types in 2017. And going into 2018, we're hearing a clear swing back to increase in wheat acres, decrease in canola acres. Soybeans have really been the crop type that have been top of mind for many growers, more so from trying to understand, can I grow these on my farm? In many areas, and in other areas, making them a larger part of the rotation. And really, we did see in 2017, there was a fairly significant pullback in wheat acres. And unfortunately, many growers choose their products that they're growing, whether it be crop type or variety, by looking in the rearview mirror. So we did see extremely high disease pressure, and in many areas, not great results in the cereals in 2016. Combined with not a great looking commodity price at seeding intention time, and we saw a pullback in the 2017 acres of wheat. Relative speaking, this year, wheat has done quite well in many areas, especially some of the drier areas. Disease pressure was down, yields have been quite good, and while there's been some problems, the profitability has improved because the commodity prices are better as well. So we clearly are seeing more demand for wheat, and we're seeing more demand for some of the new genetics that are coming out. On the canola side, we saw the largest canola crop seeded in Western Canada ever, and that was disproportionate on the percentage increase, where we saw some of the non-traditional canola areas had the largest increase in canola acres. Unfortunately for the growers in 2016, this was a great decision because a lot of those non-traditional canola areas were quite wet in 2016 and the canola did quite well. Many of those areas in 2017 had one of the driest or record dry summers, and we saw the canola acres, and especially parts of southern Saskatchewan and southern Alberta, if they did not have access to irrigation, the canola yields were quite disappointing. So while we see a pullback in canola acres, it's not anything doom and gloom. I think it's a pullback more to what we've seen over the last five-year average, and my expectation is we still likely will be north of 20 million acres, but significantly down from the 22 million plus acres this year. The wild card in that, well, what are the seeding conditions and the moisture conditions going to be in the spring in some of these more non-traditional areas? And while it had been extremely dry, we have seen some recent significant moisture in parts of southwest Saskatchewan, southern Alberta, in the snowfall that came, which with good moisture conditions, we may not see quite as much pullback, but do still anticipate some on the canola front. Soybeans very much has been the Cinderella crop where people wanted to grow soybeans all the way from Beausejour up to Dawson Creek up to down to Lethbridge. And really, I think people are realizing this year is that while there's areas the soybeans are ideally suited for, and with the genetics and the maturity ranges we have now, there's areas where soybeans are a great alternative and will fit into the rotation long term. There's other areas where they are very much a gamble, and given the right conditions and the right year, you will have a good crop. Given less than 2 inches of moisture and 35 degrees Celsius this year, you're lucky if you got 10 bushels an acre. So we do see some of the areas where soybeans are a much higher risk crop, probably pulling back in acres. Even in the traditional soybean areas where the Red River Valley, where 2016 soybeans were a clear winner economically versus canola, we've seen that situation flip-flop this year where most growers, their canola in 2017 is much more profitable than their soybeans based on the yields they're getting and the commodity prices. So we don't see much upside in the soybeans, but do see it fitting in as a continuing crop in many people's rotation. So right now our expectation is that crop would likely be flat. The other upside market we're seeing is the corn acres continue to grow. And while they aren't a major player in Western Canada now, in specific geographies, whether it's grain corn or silage or grazing corn, we are clearly seeing those acres going up. We're seeing more interest in southeast Saskatchewan, southern Manitoba, and more grain corn. And as we get into Alberta, we're seeing the corn, whether it's for silage or winter grazing, really displacing a lot of feed barley. And so we are clearly hearing that where there's much, much more interest in those crops. While there'll be some significant variances on the regional basis, overall in the big picture, this is what we're seeing. The other topic that we're hearing consistently across the board is really the battle for the acres of, in canola, which herbicide system should I use? And while the three systems up on the screen are really the predominant ones, into 2016 to 2017, we did see some pullback on Clearfield acres, and they did lose market share. And that Clearfield segment has quickly gravitated to a oil contract-driven segment. And whether it be a specialty-type oil or a special crush for a non-GMO oil type, that really dictates the amount of acres in the Clearfield segment. The market share that was lost in Clearfield in 2017 was predominantly picked up by Roundup Ready canolas, and we saw the largest growth in that, with Invigor acres growing slightly. Going into 2018, what I'm hearing and what growers are telling me, and again, there's some regional biases, but clearly we're starting to see more of a shift back to the Roundup Ready products. And we see that the Roundup Ready segment will likely grow acres. The Invigor system will still be the largest portion of the market share, but we see their market share likely weakening and more of that moving back into the Roundup Ready segment. And some of that is driven by the fact that the Invigor products had always been known for yield advantage, and they've really lost that advantage. And while they're good, strong products, there's Roundup Ready options now that are yielding as good or better than Invigor. So now it's going down to more what fits my rotation. Is it using a Roundup product or is it using a Liberty product? And that's why we're seeing some swing back into the Roundup Ready segment for canola. The other topic that is coming up and I think is driving part of what we're seeing in the last slide is tank mixing. And there's many more options to help control herbicide weed resistance with Roundup and with Liberty and with any product that's out there. What we have seen is people become too reliant in either using just Roundup Ready canola or just Liberty tolerant canola. And as you overuse either one of these systems, your risk of herbicide resistant weeds goes up significantly. So not only do growers need to rotate their crops, they need to rotate their herbicide systems, they also need to ensure that their tanks mixing products of different groups of herbicides in there to help minimize that. And there's been quite a bit of research come out over the past 2 years which clearly shows that tank mixing another group of herbicides in, whether you're using a Liberty product or a Roundup product, can significantly reduce any risk of herbicide tolerant weeds, and putting another herbicide group in your application at least once per year, whether it be pre-seed, whether it be post-harvest, somewhere in there will do more for managing your herbicide-resistant weeds than anything you can do in rotation. So we are seeing lots of questions around that because it's new technology and changing technology, but it's a good news story in that if growers are adopting this tank mix strategy, it'll help keep the Liberty trait and the Roundup trait as very viable options on the farm for a long, long time by making sure we're managing those herbicide-resistant weeds. The other thing we've seen come up this year, and I think it's of growing concern, is questions around seed treatments, especially on the insect control they provide. The seed treatments are well known and well adopted on here's what they do for the disease side of the story, but we're seeing increased pressure, whether it being from cutworms, and that was a much more significant problem this year, and flea beetles. We've seen the increase in crucifer flea beetles, but especially striped flea beetles. So there's a lot more demand where people are going, I have this insect problem. And if I get this insect problem, it's extremely difficult to manage, extremely expensive to manage with a post-emergent product in crop. And I'm much better off spending a little bit of money up front to make sure I'm eradicating that problem or minimizing that problem. And so there are solutions available for this, but growers are really starting to dig a little more into that and say, what can I do to manage this? And really with us pushing our rotations where we're growing certain crops, and in this case canola, much more, going down to 1 and 3 year, 1 and 2 year rotations, the risk of getting insect problems and disease problems is significantly increased. So we're relying much more heavily on some of these seed treatments. The good news story is there are treatments available to help manage that. So we just need to identify that with the grower ahead of time and make sure we're setting them up for success. Within the canola segment, probably the hottest topic over the last 2 years has been straight cut. Everybody's talking straight cut. They're out tweeting sell the swather. And really, I look at it and think it's a great management tool when the conditions are right with the right management of a grower. It's an option. And we've seen a lot of success stories where people are straight cutting their canola and it's working very well. Unfortunately, it's not for every grower, it's not for every situation, it's not for every geography. Did see some pictures of some canola here from last week that had not been combined, was destined to be straight cut, and after 8 inches of wet snow, it is flat on the ground and is going to be a nightmare to pick up. In that situation, the canola sitting in swaths will weather that with types of conditions much better and will be ready to combine much quicker than the straight cut canola that is now flat on the ground. So I look at it as more as the pod shatter technology gives the option under the right conditions, a grower can straight cut. Under the wrong conditions, they still may need to swath, but they have that potential option to go into straight cut. The other big development and what we're seeing in that is the development of Roundup Ready canolas that give the straight cut option. And so for growers, it's not just about, well, I need a Liberty option because that's the straight cut product. They can go to a Liberty option or a Roundup Ready option, and there's great straight cut products available for both. So under the right circumstances, it is an option for them. We are seeing more people using this just as a harvest aid, which likely gives them a larger swathing window where they may not straight cut or may not even plan to straight cut, but it does give them a larger swathing window with less chance of pod shatter. So depending on the conditions, it's a tool that growers can use, and it gives them the option to do it, whether they choose to go with a Liberty product or a Roundup Ready product. And so it's definitely growing, and we see many more acres. Third thing, which I'd already mentioned, disease pressure, very top of mind. And the topic, this slide shows blackleg on here, clubroot is very much the topic of choice right now. And really it's because there's not a lot known about it in many areas. People are hearing about disasters and horrible problems in areas, and it is spreading. It's spreading quite rapidly. So when we look at clubroot, it is a topic that growers need to be aware of. It has been found in all three prairie provinces now. The geographies where it's being found are expanding. You know, the geographies where it's being found are very much pushing their rotations, where many times it's 1 out of every 2 or 1 out of every 3 years there's canola. And really the message to the growers that we're conveying is this is something you need to get in front of and manage before it's a problem that's managing you. Clubroot is a very hard to control, hard to manage product that's much more difficult to manage at this point in time than, say, blackleg is. So where growers have it, it's forced them to go to 1 in every 4 and sometimes 1 in every 5 years before they can grow canola. So it's really pushed them back on what their options are for rotation. Plus, they're restricted in many counties of Alberta where they must grow a blackleg-resistant canola. And it's limited them on their product choice. And so what we're really portraying to growers and the message we're carrying is get in front of this, make sure you are managing it properly, limit your risk. It is a soil-borne disease. It spreads most quickly by soil. If you have any machinery that's moving from those areas, if you have any products that are moving from those areas, even if you're bringing in potatoes in southern Alberta, it could spread from northern Alberta. You need to be very careful on this, and you need to make sure you're choosing the right products. While every company in canola has clubroot-resistant products, club root resistance is like blackleg resistance. They aren't all the same. There's different genes providing club root resistance, and there's difference within the so-called club root products of which have higher levels of resistance or resistance to different strains of club root. So be very careful when you're choosing your products. Picking a club root resistant product in a non-club root infected field that's close to club root areas is your best way to limit your risk of getting that. So make sure you follow that closely. Blackleg has really been kind of pushed aside as there's been this discussion around club root. That being said, blackleg is still a much bigger issue across Western Canada than club root is, because club root's still regionalized. And the challenge with blackleg is a lot of growers have forgot how much yield kick they're getting for this. An example is last year under moist conditions in many parts of Western Canada, we saw a very, very bad blackleg year. While it wasn't bad enough that it was causing disasters, people were noticing it in their field. Well, really, by the time you notice blackleg in your field, you've probably lost 20% yield potential already. So one of the things I'm hearing over and over this year is guys are really surprised in a lot of areas how good the canola did and how good other crops did, including cereals. Part of that is clearly because the disease pressure was so much lower this year that the genetics were able to express themselves more. So even though moisture was very, very limiting, we had the moisture pulling the yield back. We didn't have the disease pulling the yield back. So when we get to more traditional years, more traditional moisture, you really need to watch what you're doing on disease pressure and really watch your blackleg ratings on that. Many companies are starting to move to a blackleg rating where they will indicate what blackleg resistant genes are in the products. So if you are in a blackleg area, make sure not only are you rotating your crops, make sure you're rotating your types of resistance you have in your canola, so that you aren't growing two different hybrids that have the same resistant gene, which really is not resisting your black or rotating your blackleg resistance. So it's managing that as well. For the sake of time, that was a few of the key things we're seeing. And again, I didn't want to get down into varietal specific because, again, without knowing the geography, the environment, the management of a grower, it's very difficult to say, here's your best genetics. In general, what I can say is all crop types, we're moving the needle a long ways on improved genetics, but we still need to cross that genetic potential with the grower's management and with the environment to help really determine what are the best crop types and the products suited for their farm. So, Mark, I'll throw it open for questions.
Great. Thanks so much, Jim. If you do have some questions for Jim, please type them now into the chat box on the bottom left-hand side of your screen. Jim, can you explain why canola acres are down even though yields were generally good? You mentioned earlier that you expect some the canola numbers to go down a little bit.
Yeah, and so what we're really seeing is the acres that are likely to come out of canola were the same acres that flexed into canola this year. And in 2017, we saw a significant increase of canola into non-traditional canola areas where people used it as a special crop. They may have grown a little bit, but it wasn't a large portion of the rotation. So when you go in the areas of South Central, Southwest Saskatchewan, Southern Alberta, we saw a dramatic increase in canola acres this year. Unfortunately, those areas were extremely dry, and people realized why they hadn't been growing a lot of canola, because we saw areas that the best crops were 20 bushels an acre, some crops were under 10 bushels an acre, and economically, it just does not compare with their other crops there. So again, with growers looking at the rearview mirror, 2016 would have been the year to gamble on canola in those areas because they were wet. 2017 was an eye-opener again that under dry conditions, I have to go to some of these crops that are better suited for the heat dry conditions. So while we don't see those acres collapsing, we do see, depending on spring conditions, probably pull back somewhere between 20 to 21 million acres.
Do you find sclerotinia is still an issue at all?
I say yes, sclerotinia is an issue. We did see, again, with the dry conditions, the sclerotinia has significantly dropped in importance on growers because they're looking at what happened this year. And with the exception of a couple localities, sclerotinia was a very minor contributor to what was happening in the crops. Sclerotinia likes moisture, and so many of the areas were on the dry side, and we just saw that disease pressure really dropped off. And it was a year where Sclerotinia, while still in the fields, did not express itself. And so growers are not quite so concerned because that's not what they saw as their reality this year.
Before we wrap things up for the day, Sarah, I have one more question came in for you. Very briefly, do you have any suggestions or comments about how to take an accurate sample to be tested?
Yes. Okay. Oh, this is a good one. So it's very important that you don't just take a sample from the bin door. So there's different ways of taking samples, but a lot of people, when they're sending a sample into the lab, they just go to the bin door and put their hand in and take a sample, and that is not representative. I think it's important that people realize the best way of taking samples is using proper triers, and also at the time that it's being cleaned. So there are automatic samplers that are set up to take a sample every few minutes, and you get lots of different primary samples to make up a composite sample. So that's one way. If you've got bags, there's actually a formula. If there's bags stacked on a pallet, there's a formula on how many samples need to be taken from each bag and from what area. But the most important thing is to get as many small samples from the lot as you possibly can to make this sample that's called the composite, and then mix that up and then send a good portion into the laboratory. And essentially, there's an amount that's needed for specific crop kinds. So just for an example, 250 grams for just a cereal germination is all that's needed. So given that it's just such a small portion, it's obvious that you really need a good sample to represent the entire lot. Whoever the people are that are asking that, if they can contact me directly, I'd be very happy to give them the manual or the link to a manual that's actually put out by the Canadian Seed Institute. So they've got some guidelines on that. But also, the other thing too is that you can use the international seed standards as well. Does that answer the question? Because there's other ways too. If it's a load of seed coming in the truck, important to take it off the truck. From various parts of the truck, or as the truck is being unloaded, that's another way, and keeping that. And the other thing too is do not leave that sample inside anywhere near heat, because that will change the integrity of the seed.
Great. Thank you so much, Sarah. Well, that's all the time we have today. I'd just like to thank our three speakers for making time in their busy schedule to share their insights and expertise. I hope that everyone's found this information valuable. Again, I'd like to pass on a huge thank you to our sponsors, 2020 Seed Labs, Canterra Seeds, and CCAN, for their support. I also quickly want to thank Kyle Draduani and Teresa Kurjewitz, our team working behind the scenes, for their dedication to making this a successful and informative event. Again, this presentation will be on our website at germination.ca within the next couple of days. So please visit our website and feel free to download it as a video or a podcast as well. Thanks for your attention, and on behalf of the team here at Germination, we hope you have a great rest of your day. Bye for now.